Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for joining the call for our Q3 trading update. I'm joined as usual, but very sadly for the last time, I suspect, by Nicholas Cadbury, our Group CFO. We've been totting up. We think this may be his 50th appearance on one of these calls, so do make sure you have lots of extra, especially tough questions for him today, please. I'm also joined by our U.K. Finance Director, Hemant Patel, and by Paul Timms, our Head of Investor Relations, both of whom will be well known to you. I hope you've had a chance to review the Q3 release this morning, but it did go out at 7:00 A.M., and so I'll start with a very brief overview just to bring everybody up to speed before we hand over to Q&A, when we will all be happy to answer any of your questions. During this quarter three, which ran until the 25th of November, we continued to trade very well and significantly ahead of the market in the U.K. Total accommodation sales were 10.6% ahead of full year 2020 levels. Just to be clear, that comparator of full year 2020 is the year before the COVID crisis, so the like-for-like period would have been Q3 2019. That accommodation sale being 10.6% ahead of pre-COVID levels, that represented 14.9 percentage point outperformance against the mid-scale and economy market. The value pub and restaurant sector in which we operate remained more challenging, and our total food and beverage sales were down 11.1%. That was in line with the segment or the sub-segment of the market that we're in. As we moved into quarter four, which started at the end of November, ran through December and to date, U.K. accommodation sales actually remained resilient. In December, total U.K. sales were 5% ahead of the same period full year 2020. Now clearly the impact of the Omicron COVID variant has resulted in a slight softening of the hotel bookings in recent weeks, but it's a bit too early to assess what impact that's going to have, and I'll come on to a forward look in a moment. We did see, however, a greater impact of that Omicron on our F&B sales, which were down 17%, compared to full year 2020. If we look forward into our next financial year, which starts in March, and in the absence of further material COVID restrictions, we are very optimistic about performance, and we're maintaining our expectation that Premier Inn U.K. like-for-like RevPAR run rates will recover to pre-COVID levels during 2022. As you all know, sector cost inflation next year is expected to be above historic average levels, but we expect to be able to use some of our advantages to largely offset these higher levels of inflation. That by advantages, I mean in this regard, cost efficiencies, estate growth, and yield management. Turning to Germany. In Germany, our open hotel estate now stands at 32 hotels with a further 43 hotels in the pipeline. Despite the current restrictions, the German portfolio performed in line with the market in Q3, achieving occupancy levels of nearly 60%, up from 47.5% in Q2. Subsequently, the increased government restrictions have acted as a significant drag on market demand, and our occupancy levels have reduced in the last six weeks. We are, however, extremely confident in the opportunity for the group to create value in Germany. We think that opportunity continues to be compelling, and we will therefore continue to look for opportunities to grow the estate and deliver good long-term returns. Omicron has proved to be a not unexpected bump in the road, but notwithstanding that, Whitbread remains in a very significant position of strength. The good performance of the group in the period resulted in an operating cash inflow for the period to the end of December, and we have a very strong balance sheet and liquidity position. That strong balance sheet is enabling us to invest in our growth strategy through the cycle and during a period when others are constrained. In the U.K., we're going to continue to grow through maximizing our considerable competitive advantages. That's our national scale and our focus on the domestic budget accommodation sector, and the fact that we operate the number one brand in the U.K. with a very broad customer base. That, alongside our direct distribution and best-in-class operating model, are all underpinned by a market-leading sustainability program. These are quite unique attributes, and they give us a strong and sustainable platform with a flexible commercial model that allows us to deliver effective pricing, estate growth, and cost efficiency, ensuring that we're in a stronger position than others to offset inflationary headwinds and return to our pre-COVID margins. While in Germany, the opportunity to replicate this platform and create long-term sustainable value remains compelling. Now, I'm just going to hand back to Nadia, who's hosting this, so that we can start the Q&A. Now, in order to have an efficient call this morning, and given it is a quarter three trading update only, could I ask you initially to limit your questions to two per person? I know it's a big ask, but we can go round again if there are remaining questions and we haven't run out of time. So let's try that this time.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypads. If you choose to withdraw your question, please press star followed by two. When preparing to ask your question, please ensure that your phone is unmuted locally. And our first question today comes from Jamie Rollo of Morgan Stanley. Jamie, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Jamie, and Happy New Year.
Morning, everyone. Happy New Year. Thanks, Alison. Just two from me, please. Just the first one on pricing. Your third quarter rate around 4% above the November 19 quarter, and it looks like it strengthened during the quarter despite the VAT increase. Could you talk a bit about what's happening out there in terms of sort of consumer acceptance, what your competitors are doing, your sort of confidence in pricing remaining robust? And secondly, the other question just on the cost guidance. If you could please break down that sort of 100 million into the various buckets, talk about some of the other discretionary items, some of which were deferred, which, you know, so what the extra cost is there, please, and if there's any sort of upside to that 7-8%, or is that really it, you think? Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Jamie. I'll do the first question on pricing, and then I'll hand to Nicholas to do the cost detail question. On pricing, I think we probably talked about this the last time we spoke at the half year results, just in terms of thinking ahead to pricing strategy going forward and into next year, given that there are, as you know, inflationary headwinds for the entire sector. This, we're not alone here. This is a sector-wide issue. And given the strength of demand that we saw, post coming out of lockdown last year, and the summer before, we are pretty comfortable that we will have a pricing lever to be able to pull, and that we will see, of course all of this is dependent on demand, but what we're expecting to see, if I think holistically then about demand, is leisure has stayed strong. It stayed strong through the Christmas period. I think we had an 80% occupancy rate on New Year's Eve, for example. So even though we had, London and Edinburgh cancel their New Year celebrations, I think a lot of people in the north moved south over the border and into places like Newcastle, and people in the west in Wales moved across the border into Bristol, and we had pretty full areas in those places. So we're expecting leisure demand to be pretty buoyant and to come back first, as it always does. And for B2B, in terms of blue collar, to stay resilient as it has throughout the entire last 2 years. So the swing is the work from home order and the white collar workforce, which we had started to see a reasonably good return of, actually. And so I would expect that if these restrictions are relatively short term in nature, certainly not expecting to see what we had last year, which is a closure for the whole of January to May. We're expecting, to see more opening post the booster program much earlier. Then we'd expect that bounce to be better with white collar because people have been used to doing that and going back. So I think the area still where it's really hard to call is central London, the very centre of London, in relation to inbound. So we think demand will be good. We will obviously be testing continuously for how much of the independent sector may have decided to call it a day, and therefore, the opportunity that gives us to grow into that space and take share. We think we're still taking market share, by the way. And we think that our pricing, where we expect demand to be good, our pricing will also be strong. And we expect that to be a market phenomenon and that our competitors will follow.
Yeah. I think if you're an independent sector, you've got no option but to, which is 50% of the market, you've got no option to put your prices up with all the, you know, they're not hedged on their electricity bill. They've got all the same inflation headwinds that we're seeing right across the sector. Just in terms of the cost guidance overall, we've talked about some of these over in the half one results overall. I mean, the biggest one overall is our biggest cost for us is our labour bill, of around about 500 million and we've put our wages up by about 5% in at the end of October overall, but we flagged at the time that we think we're going to need to go higher at the moment. Now we're seeing retention is improving, we're actually finding it a little bit better to recruit people at the moment, but this is the quiet time of year, so this is when we have the kind of lowest number of kind of hours worked. So we are expecting, as you get back into that kind of March, once the market picks back up again, once you get that kind of demand coming through, we expect again to see more pressure on kind of labour inflation overall. So we're assuming that goes through as well. We're seeing kind of, we talked about utilities before, which is about 60 million of our business. We're expecting probably around about 10 to 12% inflation coming through for us. We're seeing kind of utility prices have almost doubled for the commodity price of it, but we're kind of fairly well hedged, which is why we've only been able to keep it to such low levels at the moment. And then so the rest really, laundry is probably one of the other big kind of costs for us as well. It's about £40 million worth of costs for us as well. That's kind of a fairly people-intensive business overall and revolves kind of heavily on transport and drivers as well, which is where we're seeing kind of large inflation as well across the board. But I think kind of in general, just across the kind of other areas like F&B, you know, I think it's been fairly well trailed by all the other kind of in the newspapers and the other people who've gone out over the last, that you are starting to see that kind of inflation go through. We haven't seen it so far this year because we've been fairly well contracted, but that we think that'll go up as you go into next year overall. So they're the big buckets.
Thanks,
Jamie. Can I have a follow-up? Sorry, just on the discretionary cost point, Nicholas.
Yeah, so we plan to spend about £20 million on mainly on refurbishment actually this year, and a little bit on the marketing for this quarter as well. Just with Omicron, though, we've seen a subdued sales. We're just tempering our advertising spend at the moment and saving that up. And the second thing, just with the kind of refurbishments and the kind of repairs and maintenance spend that we normally have, actually just the supply chain, just because, again, probably because of Omicron, has just been a bit more tricky, actually. So we just haven't been able to refurbish as many sites this quarter than we would do normally. So nothing that I'm concerned about at all, but just in terms of a timing issue, really.
So I meant the question was really for next year, that discretionary cost for 2023.
Yeah, so we talked about doing that. Talked about an increase in advertising. But we said at the half one that additional advertising and refurbishment would be for this year and for next year. So it stays in for next year.
Okay, great. Thanks, and best of luck in the new role. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you. Our next question comes from James Ainsley of Citi. James, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning. Yeah, morning, everybody. Good morning. Two questions from me, please. First off, the value pub restaurant sector clearly has been struggling relative to the broader industry. Can you sort of talk about why you think that is and how you might close the gap? And then secondly, can I ask about just hotel industry supply trends in the UK and Germany? Can you just comment on what you think in terms of construction activity and independent exits? And I suppose scope for more single site acquisitions or even portfolio acquisitions, please.
Yeah, well, I'll kick off and chip in, and Hemant might chip in as well on pubs and restaurants. But yes, I mean, we talked a little bit about this at the half year trading statement, because you know, the bounce of leisure back was very much premium. So there was a lot of wet-led activity, so wet-led pubs saw quite a big bounce back, and then quite a lot of premiumisation, so your sort of gastro pub end and you know, seriously upmarket restaurants also, I think, saw quite a lot of bounce back. And, you know, that there's some theory around that, around consumer behaviour wanting a treat after such a long period of being locked up and people having, you know, some savings and therefore spending more on higher and premier activity. So the value pub end was not faring as well and didn't come back as rapidly, and we fall into that segment. And you will have heard us talk previously about a number of things that we've been doing to improve marketing, to improve digital marketing, and to improve our menus and options and selections, all of which we are working on currently and launching as we go into the new year. So we're not sitting on our hands, but it isn't part of business that's particularly vibrant at the moment, given that we are in a sort of partial restriction arrangement at the minute. Do you want to add anything, Hemant?
Yeah, I think the only things I'd say on the on why it's taking longer for value pubs to come back, there's been a structural change in terms of there's less discounting, although it might be margin accretive, but less discounting in the sector as well, which means that the top line obviously comes down. And generally, as I said, it's taken longer for value pub customers to come back. They tend to be an older demographic as well, which is one of the reasons why it's taken a bit longer for them to come back.
So, I think those are the two other very good points, the discounting and the demographic. But as I said, very targeted in terms of new menus, high-quality offering, and leveraging some of our digital marketing experience and doing some targeted marketing campaigns as we go into the new year, or actually probably post this winter period and into the spring, more like. On the hotel supply trends, we haven't done any more work than we talked about last time. If you recall last time, we did we do a very detailed network plan, which we will plan to do in 2022. Getting the timing right for that's very important. So we don't want to do it early in the year. We want to do it at an appropriate moment. But because we had seen such an outperformance, in terms of our own performance and that of other budget competitor Travelodge, we did do a little survey, quite small sample, I think it was 7 regional areas and 4 in London, where we looked at what had happened to the independent supply, and we could see that there was definitely a sense that a number of independents had not reopened post-closure, and that there had been a contraction in the independent market, if that small sample proves to be typical of a broader phenomena. And so, we think we can see some of that signs of distress and I'm guessing that the emergence of Omicron and the additional restrictions we're now under with the working from home order particularly is not going to help with particularly relatively minimal government support. So I suspect that will, if anything, exacerbate the situation. But we will do a big, broad study later in the year, which will give us a much clearer perspective on the speed at which the independents are falling out of the market.
But anecdotally, there's the very limited new supply coming in, both in the UK and in Germany.
Which, again, is as you would expect.
And in terms of acquisition opportunities?
Yeah, in if we're turning our attention to Germany, Germany is, significantly worse hit in terms of lockdown and government restrictions, and much more complicated array of very severe restrictions in Germany for much longer during this winter period. And they were already lagging the UK in terms of the bounce back in demand. So I would expect Germany to have to be, more difficult for more months than the UK trajectory that I talked about a minute ago. And that obviously won't help the very large and fragmented independent sector in Germany. The difference being, however, that there is still quite strong government support. That support is in place until the end of March through both grants and Kurzarbeit. And so that is allowing people to prolong and therefore we're not seeing as much movement in that market as potentially will happen in due course. once that support falls away. Equally, we also haven't seen much in the way of change in pricing for property, which remains quite high. So, again, acquisition of freehold in Germany is still quite difficult. That may change over time, but we've certainly not seen an early sign of it yet.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And best of luck in the new role, Nicholas.
Okay.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Vicky Stern of Barclays. Vicky, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Vicky.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Yes, happy New Year.
Thanks. Just a follow on Germany. Does anything about the lack of the recovery that we've seen, I suppose the contrast in performance with that market versus, say, the UK or the US, just make you feel a little bit more hesitant about the medium-term prospects there and sort of how much capital you'd want to deploy in the region? Or you think this is really just, you know, short-term, as you say, a few months kind of lag and then back fully on course? And sort of related to that, do you think it's still then feasible that you could see this business break even by 2024? And then just a quick one on real estate. You obviously sort of referenced a few transactions that have taken place last year that sort of seemed to underscore the previous asset value. I'm just wondering if you are planning on sort of getting another broader, bigger revaluation of the property done, and if so, sort of when?
Yeah, so let's start. I'll start with Germany and pass to real estate for Nicholas. You might add in a few words on break even as well, Nicholas. But we haven't got a diminished sense of excitement about the German market. All the things that made it a great market for us, specifically for us, you know, the fit with our own model into the structural fit within Germany is still excellent, and all of those underpinning reasons for us to be confident about Germany remain, plus a bit of extra confidence. So, you know, it's still a big market. It's still highly fragmented. It's 73% independents. Those independents have started to be in decline. There isn't a dominant player. You know, there's still great opportunity for us to be the number one player in Germany to replicate the platform that we operate in the UK, which is so strong in that other market. So lots of reasons to be very positive. But, of course, with some incremental reasons, which is that we have been trading now in Germany, albeit pre-COVID only with a handful of hotels and only two for a period. But the brand has gone down very well with the consumers of the product. The product itself is very, very well thought of, and our guest scores are absolutely excellent. And we have been trading, even with a larger number of hotels, at market levels of occupancy. So we do think Germany will, you know, just be more problematic to come out of this crisis, given where they are and how they manage vaccination, etc. But we think it is short term, and we're very confident about the medium term outlook. And in terms of break even, it's never really our target here, and I just know it is in terms of how people need to think about valuing the business and wanting to know when they've got a valuation against a cash flow or an operational profit or a break even. But the more we grow, the more potentially you push back break even, and we're actually quite keen still to grow if we can. But yes, we could see our way clear to reaching break even in the same time frame as we've previously spoke about, Vicky, which is 2024. But that will depend on what we manage to do in terms of incremental growth. So things can change. What we'll try and do, and we talked about this before, and it wasn't appropriate for a Q3 trading update, but when we get to the year end, we'll try and start to be able to articulate, you know, the operating profit and the way that the sites are maturing in a more sensible way, so that people can think about the way that they value the business as it grows.
Sorry, just on the valuation. Yes, we talked about in the half one results that we had seen some transactions in the marketplace, property transactions of leasehold sites, and they were at reasonable yields, fairly similar to the valuation that we did in late 2018 as well. So, and we were just giving the indication that on that basis that the valuation looks like it was holding up quite well. It's been very few transactions though, and even less so kind of in the wider hotel market at the moment. Most of the hotels that have been sold have been kind of distressed sales, so you haven't seen those sort of yields being maintained right across the board at the moment. So I think it's probably too early still to kind of do a valuation that I think would be useful overall. So we haven't got one planned at the moment, but as you know, Vicky, we're always open-minded to do it. So I think we'd like to see a little bit more kind of evidence in the marketplace that those were being sustained before we even thought about doing that at the moment. But I think if you stand back looking at our, you know, the strength of the brand, the strength of our kind of covenant overall, you know, that we don't see a big reason why the valuation of our property would have declined significantly.
Very helpful. Thanks.
Thanks, Vicky.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Bilal Aziz of UBS. Bilal, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning.
Morning, everyone. Morning. Happy New Year. Just one from my side, please. I think around about this time last year, or maybe slightly later, actually, you mentioned the step towards travel management companies. So perhaps just a bit of an update there. How are you progressing? What has that done for you so far? And expectations, please. Thank you.
Yeah, we did talk about travel, adding travel management companies into our repertoire of distribution. And for those that don't recall it, I know you do because you've asked the question, but for those that don't, you'll recall that we view travel management companies being quite different essentially to Booking.com or Expedia or other forms of commission-based travel agency, because because they reach a consumer we couldn't reach without them. Because if you're using a travel management company because you work for a large corporate particularly, you're not allowed to book directly, and you can only use that travel management company. So the idea is that it doesn't cannibalize in the way that using an online travel agent just cannibalizes business which would otherwise have come to us anyway without the commission. So yes, we were exploring that, and we also thought that if there was going to be some sort of more structural reduction in white-collar travel, which is about 25% of our business, that we would be able to offset that with increasing our distribution into a platform of travel management companies that we have not previously participated in. So we've made quite good progress on this in that we have signed up quite a number of travel management companies now, and in some cases linked technology where we have to link technology, and so we've got a pretty good platform. What we're waiting for, however, is for the white collar and international travel to return, because that's predominantly where travel management companies are playing, and so because they have been the last of the cohorts that we talk about to return, we haven't really seen yet the upside benefit that we would be expecting once we get a full recovery of business travel and international travel. So we're set up for it, but we haven't yet seen the benefit in the numbers.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, answers the question.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Tim Barrett of Numis. Tim, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello, morning everybody. Morning. Two things, please. On just to come back on that pricing question for the current financial year, is it the case that you're still targeting, that the main target is occupancy in the low 80s, and that your algorithms are solving for that, but you just anticipate they're consistent with higher average room rate? And then secondly, on pub restaurants, obviously we talked a bit about the minus 17%. Anecdotes in the market would suggest that was very lumpy at the market, particularly a couple of weeks pre-Christmas. I know you don't want to give weekly like-for-likes, but is that your experience as well? Thanks a lot.
Okay, we'll do a one and two split on this again. Pricing. As a company, you know we like to be full and to have good occupancy, and not least because actually economically it plays out very well for you to be fully occupied and for your brand to be well known, and it plays out in lots of other different ways if people are continuously using you and remain loyal to you. But the pricing, I think, is a lot more sophisticated than that, and really has had to be, because algorithms don't work in a period where, you know, post a dislocation like COVID in the way that they would historically have. They're just not as smooth to operate because they haven't got the same depth and level of previous experiences, which is what an algorithm works off. And so actually there is quite a lot of intervention required on pricing. And an example of that would be, of course, we want to be occupied, well occupied. But in some places, we know that we will be full. And although there's been a lot of movement to short-term booking and less visibility on long-term booking than there was pre-COVID, for obvious reasons, because the life's uncertain and people don't want to book too far in advance and then have to cancel their plans. So they're generally planning things at shorter time horizons. So where we know that we're going to have a full hotel, we have to hold our nerve. We don't, you know, we're not starting prices as low and going up very slowly up ladders. We're sort of holding higher prices at opening and waiting for that demand to come in because we've seen that we've got shorter lead terms to deal with. So, I mean, a good example of this would be I myself attempting to book the new key Premier Inn for next summer because my daughter is going to be down there and I thought it might be handy to have a backup plan. I guess she's only 17 because she's going to the Broadmasters Festival. I can tell you, I looked at our site in Newquay. It is wonderful. If you're thinking about a sandy holiday, it's right on the beach, on Fitzroy Beach, so it's a fantastic location. However, it is maximum priced all the way through, so that, you know, that we're not on a ladder at that site, and certainly not for the Broadmasters Festival. So, so for some things, we'll be that. Where we know, however, that demand is going to be sluggish or low, or that we might not fill, I think our job is to make sure we take every penny of the market, of the available market, and leave our competitors with the least amount. And so, if that means starting prices lower for in areas of weaker demand to maximise the occupancy, to make sure we get every bit of that occupancy, then I think that that's a good strategy for those areas. And we are much more filleting the estate into our assessment of demand and managing pricing in that way. I hope that makes sense, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the pub side, lumpy, I wouldn't necessarily call it lumpy. I mean, what we saw coming into Christmas, as soon as Omicron was kind of getting ahead of steam ahead, we saw parties, group parties, office parties being cancelled across the whole of the sector, not just with us. So we saw it fall off quite immediately. It was a good Christmas day, so people felt like people were kind of staying awake, locking themselves down. But when it came to actually celebrating the kind of Christmas day, it was a good day overall. And I think that was not just us again, but it was the whole market as well. But I think you're likely to see that until the government really announces, you know, the end of Plan B, I think you're going to see kind of quite a suppressed market overall, particularly at the value end where, you know, where people who eat in the value kind of segment are people probably being hit most hardest by the virus, the impact of the virus overall.
Okay, brilliant. And thanks for the travel tips.
That's my sales pitch for Premier Newquay.
Okay, thank you. Our next question comes from Jafar Mastari of BNP Paribas Exane. Jafar, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello, good morning.
Just one for me on the pricing mix. You've just alluded to that, but okay, the net for the group is single-digit positive pricing. But in the October presentation, you showed us some KPIs for two types of properties. There were areas of high demand, like Cornwall, where pricing can be up plus 60%. And then there's areas of low demand, like Glasgow, where pricing this summer was down as much as minus 28. So, you know, beyond the net, I'm just curious how you expect these two buckets trend into full year 23 when you say pricing should be should show further improvement. Do you think some of those locations can realistically stay at plus 60, or do you expect those to cool off? But then how much do the laggards need to improve to produce that net further positive at the group level, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, it is a mixed bag, and you know, when I look at you know, how occupancy moved this year through the quarters, you know, regions you know, ran ahead of London, for example, and if I look at some of the occupancy, actually outer London was actually quite strong. It really was central London. So, you know, there'll be real mixes with, as you said, within the estate. And one of the things that we've spent a lot of time on in the last 18 months is making sure we understand the dynamics, catchment by catchment, and type of property by type of property, so that we can manage to optimise that mix. So we are expecting to see a good, you know, a good ability to price better across, on, you know, on a net basis across the business. Albeit, you are right, there will be pockets of areas. London, central London, for example, you know, never even at quarter three we were at the sort of high 70% occupancies, but in the regions we were in the 80s. So very, very strong. Both occupancy and room rate growth in the regions, and slightly weaker in London. So you're right, there will be pockets, but overall I think we're pretty positive that we will have some strength in pricing on a net basis for the whole business.
Thank you. So you're saying some of those will price lower. You're comfortable with that?
Potentially. Yeah. Particularly places like central London, as you say, but, you know, we haven't seen that pick up lately. So yeah. But if you see a pick up, we'll react to it, you know.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joe Thomas of HSBC. Joe, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for the question, taking the questions. Just on the pub restaurants, can you, or on the F&B, I should say, could you just perhaps give a bit more granularity on how you've done on the, you know, F&B that's attached to the hotels versus the sort of standalone size? And then secondly, as you just sort of consider the value food end of the market, are you still strategically convinced that you want to be playing there to the same extent, or is there any potential perhaps to reconfigure the estate as we are seeing one or two operators doing right now? Thank you.
Okay, good questions. And the first one is we don't really have any left standalone pub restaurants in the estate. So I mean, if we have, it's a handful, it's five or six, something like that. So we can't, we you know, there isn't a way to make that comparison. Every you know, pretty much, apart from, as I said, maybe a handful of standalones, we've disposed of all of our standalone pub restaurants. So the pub restaurants and the soulless restaurants within hotels all serve a hotel, are attached to a hotel and serve a hotel. So that, I don't know how else to answer question one. If you've got a follow-up, then ask me at the end. In terms of, we spend a lot of time every year considering what the right models are for us to operate. And indeed, we think about what models to operate in individual sites when we refurbish sites and when we build new properties. What we do know, and even from quite recent data, recent review of data post-COVID, what we do know is F&B is incredibly important to a Premier Inn guest, particularly breakfast. Breakfast more so than dinner, but dinner still important. And it's a critical part of the proposition, and it distinguishes from other parts of the market that might compete with us and makes us the popular and number one brand that we are. So it distinguishes us from traditional competitors like Travelodge, who have got less good an F&B offer, and it distinguishes from new entrants like Airbnb, who don't have an F&B offer either. And for quite a large number of people who stay with us, it's important. And we can measure some of that importance in the RevPAR that it produces for the hotel. So, and we've had lots of trials where we've removed F&B, had different formats for F&B, had breakfast rooms instead of full restaurants, etc. And we're able, therefore, to be able to distinguish which formats work for us. And so it's always important to remember when we're thinking about restaurant performance that what it doesn't reflect and what's hard to reflect is the additional revenue, occupancy and rate that we obtain in the adjoining hotel by having the F&B offer on site and supporting it. And so when we're considering what we want to do in the future, and we do often review our strategy on F&B, so it's not an infrequent question that we ask ourselves. We always have to remember that the risk you take by not doing F&B, and particularly not offering a great breakfast, is significant in RevPAR. And that's certainly RevPAR that we don't want to lose. So, and you know, we're able to look at things, for example, like what's the difference between a colo, where somebody else operates the restaurant for us, and our own performance. And our own performance gives us a significant RevPAR advantage over a colo, so over somebody else operating for us. And I guess you would expect that, given that, particularly for breakfast, other operators are not so interested in offering a great breakfast and serving your sort of premier and guest breakfast, because it doesn't make the sort of return that they would prefer to see, which they see in wet-led activity and lunch and dinner activity. So yes, I guess the short answer is yes, we do review it. Yes, we do look at it carefully. At least every 18 months to 2 years, we have a full review. And we keep it under advisory, but we do look at it in the round in terms of the whole co rather than just on the restaurant side, because of the link between the two.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry, and our next question comes from Alex Brignall of Redburn. Alex, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning, guys. Happy New Year. I've got two questions, please. The first one is on RevPAR into your FY23 or calendar 2022. And just the comments about UK versus Germany, and Germany being a little bit behind. I guess I wonder whether you could give some commentary on the impact of outbound travel restrictions on that, because German outbound travel is significantly higher than it is in the UK. And so I wonder whether if outbound travel restrictions loosen in the UK, then that might have a dragging impact on RevPAR in the UK, as it's most probably had in Germany, and maybe sort of, you know, exposures to things that would be affected by that would be hugely helpful. And then the second question, and I think you spoke about this maybe at the last call, was on supply and the lack of competition that you were seeing for new sites. We're seeing that from the other franchisors, signing levels are very low. So I wonder if you could just give us an update on that, and what competition you're seeing for any new sites, and the levels of new construction that you're seeing from people other than yourselves. Thank you so much.
Okay, RevPAR into calendar year 22 was the...
Yeah, I think the question was, is German outbound is higher than in the UK? I think it's relatively, I wouldn't say that's a big impact. I mean, we're a domestic player mainly, particularly in Germany, where business to business is higher than it is mixed in the UK. So I don't think that's a particularly large factor.
A couple of things, I guess. As Nicholas just said, for both markets, one of the things we do well is domestic and domestic budget, and that's what we are targeting in both markets. So both markets have very large internal domestic travel markets, and those are the markets that we tap into and play into. So we don't tap in particularly into inbound. Central London obviously has a drip down effect from it, but it's probably about 10% of our business in inbound, and that would be true in Germany as well. In terms of Germany being behind the UK, though, because I think that was at the core of the question, They've been behind in recovery terms for the whole of the COVID crisis. They always seem to lag a few months behind, and then they sort of go into lockdown at the same time as we do, but so they never come quite out of it. in the same way that we do. And it's quite complex in Germany. So for those of you who don't know, whilst at the moment our restrictions here are broadly, you know, work from home if you can, wear a mask and socially distance and, you know, express some caution. And in, I guess, in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, some slightly additional things around how many households can meet and et cetera. In Germany, it's a very complex arrangement by federal state, and it's much more of a lockdown than in the UK. So that's why we think it will take them longer to come out. They'll probably lag us by 3 months, as we think they've lagged us all the way through by 3 months. Their booster and vaccination rates are still nowhere near as high as ours. And they have now split and started to bring in restrictions so that actually, for example, in some states, you cannot travel for leisure at all unless you're fully vaccinated. So they started to bring in restrictions which do target the unvaccinated population. So it's quite a complicated, it's complex to operate in Germany. It's a complex structure and picture to operate within. But we do still think it will fall into the same category in that this too will end, and we will learn to live with COVID as an endemic issue rather than as a pandemic issue, and that Germany is a strong domestic market that we will play in domestically. I'm not sure whether we've sort of captured the essence of your questions, but follow up if we haven't. If we move on to supply.
Supply, as we said earlier, just we're seeing very little new supply coming into the marketplace. Overall, both from independents but also from the branded players as well. Travelodge got a little bit opening this year, but we can't see very much opening into next year. That was stuff that they'd already pre-signed. I think your question was about, obviously, competition for sites. We don't really see competition for the sites that we want versus other hotels. It's usually for alternative use, so it's either that the main competition we have is for office or residential. For the sites we're having, so we're not coming across other hotel chains really in our market at the moment. So, which is exactly what we saw the last time there was a downturn. You just get this kind of three, four year break in new supply coming into the market.
Thank you. I think I asked my first question in a highly convoluted way, or at least that's how it was interpreted. My real question was, does outbound travel not affect domestic demand? So that the pricing you talked about in Newquay might be somewhat lower if everyone's allowed to go to Spain. And my point about Germany.
I'm with you. Okay. I understand that question. So thank you for asking it again. I'm sure, you know, there's been lots of debate and discussion over the last two summers, I guess, about staycation boom. And the question is, you know, was it a staycation boom? And, you know, will we get it to continue for next year and the year after? The signs are that overseas travel, of course, will reopen. It's going to be quite expensive. You can already see that from the prices of both accommodation overseas, but holidays overseas and airline travel. And airline capacity is in itself in some ways constrained because there's been a lot of capacity come out of airlines, and so therefore the prices will be higher. So I suspect there will still be a strong demand, either for people who don't want to travel to stay in the UK or for whom travel abroad is actually quite expensive to stay in the UK. So we are quite positive about it. Bear in mind, however, we don't predicate that all of Premier Inn business on staycation, in that we have places that are bucket and spade holiday destinations, probably about 15% of our business. This is about broad demand returning across the UK for lots of different events and leisure. We're mostly a short-term destination, not a two-week holiday destination hotel group, as you'd imagine. And so what we saw last year and continue to see all the way through quarter three and into quarter four, even post-Omicron, were people wanting to travel to see family and friends, go to events and do special things. And we're expecting that sort of leisure behaviour to be just as prominent next year as it has been this year.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Sorry for making you answer the question twice.
Don't worry.
Thank Thank you. Our next question comes from Stuart Gordon of Berenberg. Stuart, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning, guys. Just to help us a little bit as we move forward, there's been a lot of moving parts in the last few years, obviously. But what kind of RevPAR incrementally increase on 2020 do you think we need to see to get PBT in the UK back to the 415 it was in 2020? Because obviously we've had significant moves in terms of some of the cost savings you've done, but also in the inflationary pressures. Thanks.
Good question, Stuart. But we've given you, we've given you quite good guidance in our cost base now. So if we gave you guidance on our RevPAR, we might as well tell you what we think for the whole thing. I'm not going to give specifics on that overall, Stuart, because I think the Omicron variant. It is bumpy along the way. We've given you kind of guidance that we think for FY20. This coming year coming up, that we'll get back to like for like positive at some time during the year. So that's where we are in terms of where our forward guidance is at the moment.
Yeah, and on margin, which is the other side of that coin, we've purposely shied away from giving new guidance on when we think margin. If you remember, originally we thought we would get our revenue back to pre-COVID levels by 23, and the margin would come back the year after in 24. So we've brought in the guidance for the top line by a year into next year, and in fact we've been trading at some points this year, ahead of pre-COVID levels, but we're still, being quite cautious about where the inflationary pressure comes and the scope and nature of our pricing and cost efficiency program, and therefore when essentially we will get the margin back. So we haven't formally changed our guidance at all, but we're not going to. Probably we'll have a better sense when we get to the full year results in April.
Okay, thanks very much.
Sorry not to be more helpful, Stuart.
That's okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul Ruddy of Goodbody. Paul, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Morning, guys.
Morning.
Morning. Just effectively a bit of a follow-up from that question, and you've clarified some of it, but just on that medium-term margin recovery and your kind of continued confidence in it, and I hear what you're kind of saying on timing, but just some of the assumptions in that, reiterating that margin, recovered margin guidance, is that mostly around your confidence in pricing dynamics and in demand in the medium term? Or is there some assumption around some of the cost inflation we're seeing being transitory? Just feels like there's an awful lot more inflation in the system now than when you initially made those remarks.
Yeah, I think probably the change from where we made those remarks is probably a bit more confidence in being able to pass some of the price on. But it's a number of things. I guess it's the benefit from the growth of the estate that we've got, the market share benefits we're going to get. We think from the independent market declining, which gives us more kind of ability to kind of build our occupancy and both our pricing over that period of time. So it's both a combination of those things plus kind of the efficiency program, which we announced and is still the same as we announced it back in October.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Paul. As a final reminder, that's star followed by one if you would like to ask a question today. And our final question at the moment comes from Ivor Jones of Peel Hunt. Ivor, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Ivor.
Morning. Happy New Year. Thank you.
To you.
I guess picking up on a bit of the last two questions, really, I've been thinking about the route to 110,000 rooms and the projected return on the capital required to get there. You've talked a lot about what feel like some structural increase in costs. Construction costs feel like they're up, raw materials for construction, etc. Is that plan under review, either in terms of quantum or location of where those new sites are going to be, or in terms of the projected return on capital, are the cost changes offset by your projected revenue changes? Thanks.
Okay. That's a good question. And I'll answer it in a couple of parts. First of all, We've talked a little bit before, you'll have heard us talk about the network planning that we do every couple of years. So we're due to do a network plan this year. The network, every time we do a network plan, the landscape's changed. What doesn't generally change is it too much is where you might need a new hotel, which is in a virgin catchment, because generally a virgin catchment stays a virgin catchment, but i.e. a place where we haven't currently got a hotel. But what has historically often happened when we do the network planning exercise, and this was pre my time and my predecessor's time when network planning was done, is often the runway is extended. And the runway is often extended because the independent sector has continued to decline and therefore allowed for growth, and maybe other competitive elements in the landscape have changed, or our brand's got better, or our performance is better. But we do a network plan to make sure that where we think there will be demand for a hotel and where we think supply is there, including, you know, removing demand that Airbnb would take from a catchment, that we understand that at a very granular level, down to about 4,000 postcodes level, so really granular. And we understand exactly what the supply landscape looks like, which involves, you know, actually a big exercise in establishing if independents really have left the market, whether they're still trading or not trading at all, and in what quantity, and what new build is going in, what new supply has got planning permission or is being purported to be moving into a market. And that gives us the runway that we then are, you know, give a sense to the market of what we think that we de-risk that a bit, and then we give a sense to the market of what it looks like. We don't, you know, tell you the number as it comes out raw, because we don't want to put into the market you know, any sort of false expectation. So we do a bit of de-risking. So that's where the 110,000 has come from, and we will do a new network plan this year, and it tells us where very specifically we want our new hotels to be, and it is based on, you know, on us having a really good model. And then when we come to put hotels in, we are very rigorous about the model that we use to assess the returns profile over time and the NPV of the property. That is updated with a huge amount of regularity, at least 6 monthly, but in periods of high inflation more often, so that we are certainly not kidding ourselves, and every single site that we sign up to is individually assessed and has to hit a hurdle, and that hurdle is, you know, akin to our current returns. So what we don't want is to open new hotels and have declining returns profile. So we're not looking to open until we hit WACC, for example. We want to maintain a WACC plus returns profile for investors. The other thing we then do once every 6 months is we review all capital that's been spent over the previous 5 or 6 years, and we make sure that its returns have produced the outcome we thought they first would, and we adjust models if they haven't. We understand why and what's happened, and we make sure we adjust models so that we don't perpetuate any issues. And then finally, the final point in this one is because of COVID, we scrubbed our entire pipeline, we've continued where we signed new pipeline to have a weaker projection on the top line, a later return to demand, which obviously impacts the NPV. And we've included all inflationary costs in terms of development costs and cost of rent, etc., within the models. And we scrubbed our pipeline and removed properties which no longer hit hurdle when we put in the impact of COVID. So where we could, which to a large extent we could. So we're quite confident that the pipeline we currently have is robust and meets its returns hurdles, and will be a good pipeline to open over a period of time. And when we do the network plan, we'll then have the future runway, which will be impacted. That runway, for example, would extend if we do see that the independent sector falls out more rapidly than it has been doing at its, you know, standard 1% a year, which is what we think possibly will be happening. I don't know whether that answers all your questions. It's quite holistic in terms of all the things that we do in this area.
That's really helpful setting out of the framework. It did make me wonder, though, if there is to be a structural decline in white-collar demand as a result of working from home. Would that affect plans for London more than the provinces? Would we see a change in the geographic skew?
It's possible. I mean, certainly during the pandemic, we've seen the weakness in London, and that's about also, it's not just about domestic working from home. Funnily enough, we've seen quite a buoyant amount come back from a domestic perspective. I mean, people have changed their working practices. So actually, where some demand's fallen away, some has arrived. Some of you may recognise this, but we do have people who now come into big cities for a couple of days a week and stay with us, that would previously have commuted, but they've moved out further away. So they now come in and stay for a couple of days, and then they work from home for a couple of days. So actually, we've seen some demand we didn't used to have come back. So I think there's a bit of tilling and lading in it. But certainly, London is not just about domestic travel. Actually, it's about inbound, and the inbound business and leisure travel into London has remained incredibly weak. And how much of that comes back and how fast remains to be seen, and could well be a weakness. That'll be reflected in the work that we do, and certainly in our view. As you know, we have lower market share in London than our general market share, so we're not in any form of overcapacity in London for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We currently have no further questions, so I'll hand the call back over to you, Alison, for any closing remarks.
Yep, just want to say a big thank you to everybody for being on the call. If you've got any follow-up, of course, we'd be delighted to help, so please do come through to the IR team. And thank you, Nicholas, for helping me choreograph that Q&A session.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Take care. Have a good day.